Oh, good evening to you. This is the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Tonight we hear about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. Our hosts and speakers will be Judy Ansel and Jim Turner. Judy is, of course, the producer of KKFI's Heartland Labor Forum. And Jim is the Missouri Chapter Liaison to the Sierra Club's Responsible Trade Program. Judy Ansel is also Director of Worker Education and Labor Studies at the University of Missouri at Kansas City. And we're going to talk a lot about this. It's an interesting trade agreement. It will impact everyone, some adversely, some not. But this is going to be an in-depth look at what that trade agreement contains. This program was recorded on Sunday, March 27th of 2016 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. We will follow our usual format tonight. We'll have about 35 minutes of the presentation from Judy and Jim. We will take a short break, and then we will have questions from the audience for our hosts tonight. So let's go right to the introduction. This is the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.
Well, good morning. My name is Craig Volland. I'm a member of the Forum Committee. This morning, we have a really interesting program that I think is very relevant to the current election circus. We have a panel of two. Jim Turner is, until very recently, was chair of the Missouri chapter of the Sierra Club. And he's also a member of the network, the national network of people in the Sierra Club who are interested in international trade issues. So he's well-versed in this issue. And then we also, many of you familiar with Judy Ansel. Today, she's a longtime professor at UMKC, but today she's representing the Cross-Border Network, which deals has for many or decades dealt with these cross-border issues, and that's part of the Missouri Trade Justice Coalition. So without further ado, I'll hand it over to Judy.
Thank you, Craig. Thank you all sturdy people for coming out on this snowy Easter. I guess it's better than working in your yard.
Oh, Judy, I forgot to introduce Melissa. Melissa, who works with Judy, is going to be handing are passing around a sign-up sheet for the Cross-Border Network so you can be kept up to date on this activity. I apologize.
Thanks. And the Cross-Border Network is a local organization which our slogan is we support workers across borders and we support the workers who cross borders. In other words, we're involved in both globalization and immigration issues. And we particularly focus on Honduras and Mexico in our international work, but we also have organized the Missouri Trade Justice Coalition and are soon going to be actually introducing in that coalition a resolution to the City Council to oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership because it's bad for all of us. And we're going to try to explain why that is in this slideshow. The Trans-Pacific Partnership was signed last fall by its 12 member states and will be coming to Congress sometime this year, we think. And so what is it? It's first off, it's multilateral. It's many countries. And it's a trade and investment deal among those 12 countries, and they're all around the Pacific Rim. I'll show you a map in a minute. From my point of view, an enforceable global governance system for and of large corporations. I really see it as a corporate power grab, one of many that we've seen over the last several decades, that where big corporations, multinational corporations, are really reordering the global economy and global governance. It has no expiration date. Any changes that will be made after it's passed by the various parliaments and congresses of the member countries would have to be agreed to by everyone. And countries will be required to conform their laws to the provisions of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So it essentially trumps local laws, state laws, and federal laws. And if we don't change our laws to conform to it, then we will be penalized, or any country will be penalized. It's called a free trade agreement, but it always boggles my mind. These free trade agreements are huge. This one's 6,000 pages, and if it's about deregulation of trade, so-called free trade, why do you need so many pages of legalese? And so my own view is that free trade is really a lie. It's not about free trade. It's a system of managed trade which writes rules that protect the participants. But as I'll try to make clear, the people who actually write it are corporate interests. The one on top on the right is what the U.S. Trade Representative's Office of the President is using for its logo, saying that the TPP is made in America, or something like it's going to create more made in America, which is also a lie. In fact, it's actually outlawing laws like Made in USA, or what's called local procurement or federal procurement laws, mandating that certain things be made in America. All right, so in this map, you see the blue, in blue, the countries that are party to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, all of North America, in South America, Peru and Chile, in Oceania, we have Australia and New Zealand, and then in Asia, we have Singapore, Brunei, Malaysia, Vietnam, and Japan. And they make up the 12 countries that are part of the TPP. The countries in red are countries that have indicated that they'd like to join, or they're interested in talking about joining. Okay, so TPP is one of three mega trade deals. Negotiations are going on right now for the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is with the EU. And also a very little talked about trade agreement called TISA, which is the Trade and Services Agreement, which will amend what's called the GATS, the General Agreement on Trade and Services, which is actually probably, from the point of view of working people, is probably the most threatening. The question is, why do we need the TPP? We already have trade agreements with all of those countries. So U.S. has, NAFTA, it's got free trade agreements with Peru and Chile. It's got a free trade agreement with Australia. So, half of the countries in the TPP we've already got trade agreements with. So why are they doing this mega deal? And, my answer to this is because it's really not about trade. It's about everything else. These are the chapters of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The ones on the left are not about trade. And you see there's many more of them than the ones on the right, the top right. Those are the chapters, there's six of them that specifically deal with trade, tariffs, kinds of issues. But the ones on the left deal with all sorts of things. Financial services, investment, telecom. You can read those. And so there's a lot more to this agreement than simply trade in goods. And so what it's doing is writing the rules for all of those things. Some of you are probably interested in internet freedom. there's a chapter on those kinds of communications. Some of you might be interested in pharmaceuticals. There's a chapter on patents. There's just all kinds of things that you don't normally think of as trade. And so what the TPP does is it goes way beyond what our normal view of what a trade agreement would be in order to set new rules and new regulations. Now, the TPP was negotiated in secret. The input was really extensive from the 16 working groups representing over 600 corporations or corporate trade associations who were advisors who had access to the text that was being negotiated and influence over what would be in it. The negotiators hoped that it would remain secret for 4 years after it was actually signed and approved. But there was so much opposition to the secrecy of the deal that they were forced to publish the text finally after it was signed last November. You know, that means even members of Congress, you might have read about this in the news, even members of Congress who wanted to see what was being negotiated had to basically swear themselves to secrecy, go in a basement room in the Capitol. They could not bring pencil, paper, laptop, anything to take notes on, and they weren't allowed to talk about what they saw in the text of the agreement. These are members of Congress who have to approve it, let alone state governors or other governmental bodies that will be affected by it. They had no access whatsoever. So other countries knew what was being negotiated while U.S. citizens did not. Basically, what we learned about the Trans-Pacific Partnership during the years of negotiation was from leaks. And, you know, bless WikiLeaks, because they leaked a lot of the text beforehand. Obviously, some people weren't sworn to secrecy. So how will the TPP impact the economy and jobs? Well, first off, if we look at past trade agreements, NAFTA, the Central America Free Trade Agreement, the free trade agreements we have with individual countries, we have a number of them. What we find is that, as far as our manufacturing base, it's being gutted. We've lost one out of four manufacturing jobs since we negotiated NAFTA and since China joined the WTO in 1995. And I'm not going to blame all of that on these agreements, but they certainly have a substantial part of that loss of our manufacturing base. This has devastated towns. Look at Flint, Michigan. Is a great example of what happens as a result of the offshoring of employment and the ability to import the goods that are offshored back duty-free into the United States. The lack of any kind of real compensation or creation of real jobs for the people who are displaced. But it isn't just manufacturing. There's tons of spin-off jobs. There's tons of service workers. I just talked to somebody who works for AT&T, and AT&T is planning on outsourcing almost all of its call centers in the next 3 years. It's called Plan 2020. And so we're going to have lots of people in our community who work at call centers who are going to be losing their jobs. We have, at this point, a bare-bones trade adjustment assistance for the people who lose their jobs. Another thing is that what this does is what this may do is deregulate further financial markets. There are many provisions in the financial section of the TPP which are actually going to cause us to be unable to pass regulations on, for instance, new kinds of financial instruments. You know, new kinds of things that Wall Street comes up with that may need regulation, because just as we learned in the whole disaster of the economy in 2007 and 2008, you know, the deregulation of the banks through the repeal of Glass-Steagall allowed for Wall Street interests to basically run amok. And what the TPP is going to do is it's going to prevent new regulations for new kinds of financial instruments. Also, the TPP prohibits the imposition of financial controls, which would slow capital flows, like you've heard of the Robin Hood tax, perhaps, which would be a tax on investments. That could be illegal under the TPP. The TPP lowers domestic content rules for how much of a product actually has to be made in TPP countries, and really is probably going to have the biggest impact on the auto industry. Because what we're going to see is Japan being able to import more cars that have more Chinese content in parts into the United States duty-free because of the lower domestic content rules in the TPP. The TPP will increase the number of temporary foreign workers in the United States. Basically, it gives a free pass for management, foreign corporations to bring in managerial workers. And I can already see how that one's going to be abused if they're working on contracts in the United States or set up operations in the United States. The TPP opens up public contracts to foreign corporations, so our Buy America provisions will now be Buy TPP. And so, like, if we're building a road or a federal road or we're privatizing our letting out contracts for defense procurement, if we're even contracting out the janitorial services at City Hall, any corporation from any TPP country will be able to bid on that work. And so, long-standing provisions that are aimed at protecting jobs in the United States will be gone. This is a huge sector of the economy, government procurement. And the TPP could undercut prevailing wage laws, other kinds of labor and environmental laws, because it will be seen as unfair advantage to, unfair damage to corporations, and Jim's going to talk about that more. So I wanted to talk a little bit about labor, and I'm actually running over, so I'm not going to talk much about it. But there's supposedly vaunted labor provisions in the TPP that are supposed to protect the fact that we, you know, the Vietnam, Malaysia, and Brunei are all in the TPP. And what the AFL-CIO has done in this report is it's completely ripped those apart. The government is claiming that the TPP labor standards are much stronger than anything previous. They say that it requires the parties like Vietnam to improve their labor laws, but there's all sorts of fine print that actually lets them off the hook, and there's very little enforceability in this. Basically, they get all the benefits of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and then they have to comply afterwards. So there's no lever against their to force them to comply. We've learned this with the Colombia Free Trade Agreement. Labor standards in Colombia are really no better than they were when they were murdering tons of labor union leaders, but they already got all the benefits from the, or many of the benefits from the Colombia Free Trade Agreement. And let me just give you a couple examples. We've learned a lot from Mexico. Labor rights in Mexico are actually worse than they were when we signed NAFTA. The minimum wage in Mexico has gone down. It's now about $4.03 a day. So, you know, in terms of a development tool, these trade agreements are actually counterproductive. Vietnam, which is joining, has currently a minimum wage of $155 a month, very, very low. Malaysia is a little bit better, $237. Brunei is a sultanate with Sharia law. There's no protections in the TPP against discrimination against people for migratory status, and there's tons of migrant workers in these countries, particularly Malaysia and Brunei. There's no protection for people for LGBT rights in Brunei. You can be executed for any kind of non-considered normal sexual act. No provisions in the TPP around protecting workers who are routinely migrating, and there's lots of human trafficking going on. Now, the TPP says we're going to eliminate slavery and human trafficking, but once again, there's no benchmarks for doing that within the TPP. So the AFL-CIO concludes that the plans and standards of the TPP are simply not going to get the benefits that we would hope to get in a trade agreement that actually respected human rights. And I was going to give you a couple examples, but I'm not. Child labor is rampant in Vietnam, you know, but again, no benchmarks for the elimination of child labor. So I'm going to skip that and give it to you.
Thank you. I helped organize bus trips to the East Coast to fight the Keystone XL pipeline because it's the worst form of oil impacting the environment. And it felt great to win that fight. Now we're in an even bigger fight to resist this Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I believe we can defeat it also because we have a very broad coalition. Most Americans know that excessive carbon dioxide and methane from human operations are overheating the earth. 2015 brought record high temperatures with more intense floods and fires. So we must move away from fossil fuels to renewable energy. The sooner the better. And we must produce more of our food closer to home. And we'll see that the TPP would frustrate those needs. Our markets must internalize these challenges. So we need strong government regulation at the state and national level. But the Trans-Pacific Partnership is designed to protect the corporations' dominance of our economy, and it would raise roadblocks to continuing the policy reforms that President Obama has begun. On this slide is a list of the energy advisors to the U.S. trade representatives. There's no Sierra Club in that group. There's no other environmentalist. What you see are mining groups and Halliburton and petroleum producers and so on. It's too small to read, I know, but the big problem is the investor-state dispute settlement provisions of these trade agreements. Provisions like this started out back decades ago when they started making investments in new undeveloped nations where they didn't trust the governments. And so that's when they set up policy like this. Under this provision, a foreign corporation can sue a national or state government for a new law or policy that would limit the expected future profits that that corporation was counting on in making investments, or if they can allege that it will disturb the predictable regulatory environment. Claims by corporations will be decided in private trade tribunals. Each one would be staffed by three trade lawyers. And as in so much of administrative regulation, there is concern about revolving doors. That is, a trade lawyer will take a stint of serving on these private trade tribunals, and then after months or years, go back to private practice serving international corporations once again. So one can imagine the temptations to treat these corporations well. National courts cannot review or overrule these decisions. Our judges, who are sworn to uphold our Constitution, judges with wide experience who can balance the interest of our communities, judges like Merrick Garland, now nominated to the Supreme Court, they cannot even touch these claims after they've been decided by the trade tribunal. This slide, again, too much detail to go into, but it basically shows that the bar graph shows that these trades have been increasing, these claims have been increasing annually, especially during the last 3 years on the right. They've been brought against various nations throughout the Western world on a range of policies, and I'll touch on a few such claims. The Lone Pine Resources is an American corporation which had rights to frack for gas under the St. Lawrence River bed. And probably everybody knows about fracking now. They dig a deep hole, and then they can put explosives down into it to fracture the shale and allow a lot of gas or oil to flow up. It's very troublesome. It consumes huge amount of water, and then there's much toxic wastewater which results from it. And we now know that when they try to get rid of that wastewater by pumping it down, it will, it's strongly associated with earthquakes. So the Quebec National Assembly, being concerned about fracking, set a moratorium where it would not be allowed. Lone Pine filed a claim under NAFTA against Canada for $250 million. The case is still pending. Recently, Canada filed an answer to it. How is such a case likely to play out? The next slide may give us, may help us to guess. Vattenfall is a Swedish energy company, and it had rights to build a coal-fired power plant on Germany's Elbe River near Hamburg. There's a trade treaty called the Energy Charter, Treaty, and under this, Vattenfall sued Germany to force it to weaken its regulatory limits on the plant. This plant, like all steam plants, it would pull water from the river, convert it to steam, then cool the steam, and the water, still warm, would be released back into the river, which is troublesome for the aquatic life. So in a 2011 settlement, Vattenfall won from Germany a new, more lenient water permit, allowing more use of water and weakening measures to protect the fish. More recently, now the European Union has sued Germany in the European Union Court of Justice, alleging Germany has insufficiently protected the fish species. So Germany is kind of between a rock and a hard place, and remains to be seen how that will turn out. Well, it probably was in the WTO. Either that or that treaty may have had its own provision for tribunals. I'm not that thoroughly informed on it. Now we have a big claim filed against the United States. In November 2015, President Obama rejected the Keystone XL pipeline, denied it a license so that all of this slurry would not be flowing through a pipeline down across the Midwest down to the Gulf of Mexico for export. We were all very concerned about the possibility of leaks because this is a very abrasive kind of substance. And we're concerned about the big impact on the on our greenhouse gases, too. Well, in January 2016, TransCanada filed a $15 billion claim against the United States under NAFTA. And so how is that going to play out? That's not the only tar sands pipeline. There are other pipelines that are under development, some of them by converting existing pipelines to tar sands use. One of them belongs to Enbridge, and it runs across Missouri, crossing the state line into Kansas, somewhat south of Kansas City, down in Cass County, I believe. So if there's prospects of damage, judgments like this can really chill movements to establish needed regulations. If Congress approves the TPP, we anticipate more such claims. It could bring 1,000 additional foreign subsidiaries of fossil fuel corporations who could file such claims, and that would be more than double those who now can. Fossil fuel disputes are increasing. These industries have many problems. Financial trouble, heavily burdened with debt. The fracking wells are not as productive for as long as had been predicted. So more and more disputes are arising. Plenty of reasons for these fossil fuel companies to press against regulations. Corporations have a good chance of profiting from these claims. More than half of the concluded suits have ended in a loss for the government or a settlement with the investor. Such claims could chill our regulation, various regulations of energy. Recently, President Obama said there will not be further oil rigs in the Atlantic, but we still have concerns about them in the Gulf and on the West Coast. A lot of oil and gas is in publicly owned land out in the West, and Bill McKibben has and others have shown that most of our oil and gas reserves must stay in the ground. Otherwise, we will have terrible climate consequences. Limitations like that could be pressed against with these kinds of claims. The pipelines and limits on fracking, all of these would be at risk. There's another thing about NAFTA that could be a danger, and that is that up till now, it was in the discretion of the Department of Energy as to whether to approve particular gas exports. With TPP, they would be compelled to approve them automatically. And Japan is a big importer of natural gas, so you can imagine that will produce even more pressure to frack here in the United States. Let me interject here that yesterday the Kansas City Star had an editorial in which they said that trade deals mostly work to lower other nations' barriers and upgrade their regulatory standards. Well, you can Google the phrase race to the bottom. That phrase means that there's pressure. Governments, nations will compete with each other to get manufacturing into their nation by offering weaker trade regulations. As one example, Chevron was operating in the Amazon basin, and the European courts fined the courts of Ecuador fined Chevron $9.5 billion to clean up the oil contamination there. Well, Chevron did not want to pay, so they filed an ISDS claim against Ecuador. And it appears, this still is not concluded after years, but it appears that they will be able to defy this claim. Topic of food, I'm going to jump over really quick. Growing middle classes abroad have growing appetites for meat, so there will be pressures to export more meat. And our CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations, want to do this as low cost as possible, so they would like to have weakening of our local regulations about where CAFOs can be placed and how manure must be disposed of, as well as other matters like use of antibiotics. They use huge amount of antibiotics because they have little genetic diversity in the animals that they raise. China owns Smithfield, which owns many CAFOs, and all even though China's not a member of TPP, all they have to do is build a subsidiary in Australia, and they could use that to challenge the claims. There are also concerns about our health, because TPP would strengthen patents. And more patents are taking place because this new field of biologics makes use of genetic variations and develops medications off of them. All of the nations would be obliged to recognize these patents. Patents also can be renewed just by slightly tweaking the formula and extending them for another so many years. Even surgical procedures can be patented, and all of this can reduce the access to drugs for important issues. Regulations about carcinogen products can be challenged. Well, environmentalists are supposed to be assuaged, mollified, by the fact that there's a chapter that would tell nations to reduce the amount of illegal loggings and the overfishing of the ocean. It would reduce trade in tiger parts and reduce trade in shark fins and so on, which caused much killing of sharks. But Sierra Club and other organizations have thoroughly reviewed that chapter, and they conclude that it's simply not enforceable because it's too vague. From all of these matters, we can see that international corporations are basically out for short-term profits, and we should appeal to another ethical position called corporate social responsibility. We should call upon Congress to reject the trade Trans-Pacific Partnership.
What we need is fair trade. We need trade that first off puts the interests of people ahead of the interests of profits. We need trade which is going to allow developing countries to set their own development policies rather than putting them in a straitjacket determined by the needs of multinational corporations. We need to protect public services, not privatize them. And we need to protect our sovereignty and our democracy. Fair trade is, there's something called the Trade Act that's been introduced several times in Congress. There are people who are trying to promote this, and we need to build a political movement that's going to push for that and reject the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I wanted to talk about China. Why is China out? Should it be in? Does it want to be in? What would this do to China? All that stuff, no time. But the thing is, this is really not about us, the U.S., versus other nations and who's getting the best deal. This is about people all over the world versus the power of multinational corporations to reorder the world. And I think we have to, you know, put aside all of our nationalist kind of rhetoric and really think about this as an issue of the power of corporations. The last thing I want to say is that this is a trade has become a big issue in the elections, which is a good thing. And I put together, basically, I'm just going to say, Hillary Clinton was all for the TPP until last fall when she became all against the TPP. And I know that has a lot to do with getting labor endorsements because it was clear the AFL-CIO would not endorse her without her opposition to the TPP because they're strongly against it. Bernie Sanders has always been against these free trade agreements and has worked, voted against Fast Track in Congress and is working consistently against it. Ted Cruz is against it, and he's against it because he says it's going to be a backdoor way to let more immigrants in the country and to support the Export-Import Bank. Go figure. John Kasich is really the only standing candidate now who is for the TPP, basically saying it's good for business and it's good for jobs. And Donald Trump is against the TPP because he says it was written by China. Go figure. And so I just want you to remember that we have defeated other trade deals in the past. There's a list of them. And so, TPP, it's on a roll, but it's still flushable. Thank you.
It's time to take a break. This is the All Souls Forum. You've been listening to Judy Ansel and Jim Turner break down the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. We owe you a few messages. We will do those for you, and then we will return directly for the questions from the audience tonight.
Judy, I wonder if you can try to dissect a little bit the strand of international trade policy versus globalization and all of these things that over a period of time have resulted in lower standards for American workers, but also for other workers around the world. Could you pull those strands apart a little bit and let us see, give your vision of how that has been working for a while?
Okay, well, that's a good question. It's a real complicated question, too. Globalization means many things, and there are a number of people, notably Thomas Friedman, who you see in the Kansas City Star, New York Times guy, who say that globalization is inevitable. Globalization is a process that's out of control. We can't control it and just get used to it. Okay, but I think what's really important to understand is the way in which globalization is proceeding. Whether it's, globalization of trade, globalization of manufacturing, globalization of communications, globalization of entertainment, the way it's proceeding is under rules that are being crafted by particular interests in their own interests. And so fundamentally, it's a political question. It's a question of how much power the various competing interests have vis-a-vis one another. And so, nothing is inevitable about the way it happens. It's all determined by the rules. So, yeah, globalization is occurring, But the way it's occurring is very much determined by political interests. I don't know if that answers your question, but sort of trying to put it in more political context.
Will this agreement be ratified by both houses of Congress or just the Senate? And is there any way to know in advance who's basically for this or against this so that we know which Congress people need to be supported or opposed?
My understanding is that the House of Representatives has to be in on this decision, too. We are certainly encouraged to keep in touch, make statements of opposition to our representatives, including Representative Cleaver.
Yeah, the rules are fast under what's called fast track or trade promotion authority, which limit the debate to 20 hours, I believe, on a 6,000-page document, which changes a ton of domestic laws. 20 hours, no amendments, and only a vote up or down. That's fast track, and that was passed last year in a huge fight. Both houses have to pass it. It's not a treaty, so it's a simple majority. And Representative Cleaver has said he's opposed to it. He needs to be propped up in that because I'm sure he's getting flack for it. Senator McCaskill voted for fast track. It's unclear which way she will vote on the TPP. Senator Blunt is for the TPP. Sam Graves up north, it is probably an interesting question. Probably for it. We worked on him to try to get him to oppose fast track. We had a few hopes of that, but he ended up voting for it. He needs to be pressured. We really need to keep the pressure. We are going to be introducing a resolution in the City Council in Kansas City against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There are people doing this around the country to try to build the pressure against it. What's really interesting is that in the politics of it, you know, there's certain corporate groups that are pretty pissed off about the TPP because they didn't get enough. And notably, that's the tobacco industry and that's Big Pharma. And they want more. They want renegotiation. Orrin Hatch is the spokesperson for Big Pharma, as far as I understand it. I can't remember who's representing the tobacco interests. And so there are people who, Republicans, who are opposed to it because they don't like it because it's not good enough for corporate interests. And so there's going to be these really strange bedfellows.
I noticed yesterday Hillary Clinton said, well, if you've got lemons, make lemonade. And so my concern is that this trade agreement is lemons. Well, let's stir it in with some helpful side agreements, and then we can live with it. And we should disagree with that.
My question has to do historically with NAFTA. In the process of crafting NAFTA, was that done behind closed doors, or was there input in terms of that process?
There was even less input on the part of working people to NAFTA. I think it was secret. All of these trade deals are secret. And the reason they give is that we can't negotiate in public. Because, you know, I've learned this in labor negotiations. Pretty much all labor negotiations are, you know, you don't release the details. In this case, the TPP is the most secret it's ever been. I mean, they didn't even release chapters after they'd settled them. They didn't release any text at all. But, yeah, NAFTA was a pretty secret deal, but not nearly as secret as the TPP.
And why did they originally cast a four-year layer of silence before this would become public? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, no, I can just guess. And my guess is because they knew how unpopular it was going to be, and so they wanted to have a real cushion to be able to implement it so people could see its benefits before they actually released the text.
And in terms of marketing, what's your best guess as to how this is going to be propagandized such that people will get confused and not understand the implications on it versus the other side of presenting?
If you want to see more of that, go to the U.S. Trade Representative's webpage because they have a whole song and dance there about it. But, yeah, you know, you saw that Made in America logo. It's going to be good for jobs. It's going to raise standards. And it's going to increase trade tremendously with all of these partners who we already have trade agreements with, basically.
They seem to keep talking about how this is going to cause other nations to elevate their regulatory standards when, as we can see, the opposite is likely.
Who or what were the initiating parties to get this going in the first place? Was it the U.S., the U.S. trade representatives? Was it through ASEAN? Or where was the push for this?
You know, I've heard mixed things. I read one thing last night, and I was so bleary-eyed that I didn't pay much attention. But somebody said that it was Brunei, which is like, huh? and that the smaller economies are the ones who can really benefit from the free access to the markets of the big guys. But, you know, it's always been portrayed in the U.S. as part of Obama's pivot to Asia, which was announced early on after he reneged on all of his promises that he was going to renegotiate NAFTA and not do any more of those bad trade deals. You know, then all of a sudden he decides to promote. The TPP actually started earlier. The negotiations started earlier, but he embraced them early on in his presidency. So it started under Bush, but it's certainly been pushed by the United States big time.
I would just add that a big part of the alleged justification for it is that it would help us to compete with China in trade interactions with the other nations of the Pacific Rim, when actually China already has extensive interconnections with all the countries of the Pacific Rim, and this is not going to undo that. Really, this is a way to lock even China into protecting patent rights for these multinational corporations,
and
the way I see it.
And privatizing all of its state-owned enterprises, too. I mean, the thing is, they wanted to write the rules without China there, because China structurally would, if it joins the TPP, would have to change in so many ways. And so, set the rules in. It's a docking agreement, so anybody can join if they accept the rules of the TPP. This could become the global trade agreement, because it's not simply limited to the Pacific Rim by any means. So, but China would have to join accepting the rules that have already been crafted by the U.S. and these other economies that are dominated by multinational corporations. I've heard some people say that, it's a ring around China. Eventually, it's going to exclude China, and we're doing the same thing with our military bases. We're basically, putting military bases everywhere opposed to China and Russia. And so this is just the trade part of all of that. I'm not sure that's true. You know, you hear mixed things.
Although we do hear, that was kind of my question. We do hear that argument from those in favor of the agreement that the rules will either be set by us or by China. So you better sign up to this, because they're going to run the show if we don't. That's the argument that Obama and others have made. So I think you've addressed that a little bit. I love the finesse, the lawyerly finesse. It's not a treaty, even though it trumps our Constitution and our laws. It's a mere agreement, right?
And that started with NAFTA. I mean, there were a lot of people who were outraged by the fact that NAFTA was not put through the Senate as a treaty, requiring two-thirds vote. It never would have passed, and that's why they don't do it. These things will not pass if you make them a treaty. So they're a trade agreement. And then with Fast Track, you completely trump democracy and the constitutional role of Congress.
I just have a couple of questions. One is, you do see opposition in other countries. Can you talk about how strong that is, or how likely that is to be effective? And two is, are there gag orders or such that prevent us from knowing exactly how much these settlements and claims have cost, say, the American taxpayer?
Okay. There is opposition in other countries. There's strong opposition in Canada. There's opposition in Mexico. I don't know about Peru and Chile. I just talked to somebody who does the same kind of job as I do in Australia, who was visiting, and he said that the labor movement in Australia has been tremendously weakened by conservative governments, and the opposition to the TPP is labor's divided on it, because Australia is a country that really depends a lot on investment and exports, and so there are a number of people who see it as a job creator. So it's muted there. There's been tremendous opposition in Japan, particularly on the part of farmers. And I don't know what the farming provisions actually are as far as Japan's sacred rice farmers, who have been subsidized for years. I'm sure that the American rice interests wanted to get rid of those subsidies so that they can, you know, we can start feeding Japan with our rice products. I don't know how that came down, but I know there's been a lot of demonstrations in Japan against it.
As for the United States taxpayer, I think up till now, they've been, proponents of the agreement have been arguing that, well, we in America can defeat those claims. We have not lost those kinds of claims against us. And up till now, apparently, that has been largely true. But now that we are seeing fossil fuel corporations in financial stress, it just seems more and more likely that we will see claims not only about petroleum and fracking and so on, but about CAFOs and so on, as I've said. So I think that there will be controversies in the future about how much it's costing the American taxpayer, but all we can do at this point is to make our best guess about that and try to prevent it from ever becoming an actual problem for us.
Okay, I'm going to take the last question. I read somewhere that in these three-person trade tribunals, for which there's no appeal, that the that one of the members of this, so these are private attorneys, is selected by the corporation who's bringing the claim. One is selected by the country who's defending itself, and then they agree on the third one, and if they can't, then the organizing group agrees on it. So the $15 billion claim by TransCanada for the XL pipeline, the award of $15 billion would depend on the vote of one person for which there's no appeal. Is that correct, Jim?
That's consistent with my understanding, yes. I've not read otherwise.
No, I actually read the investment chapter, and I think that's what it said. So $15 billion fine against the United States relies on the vote of one private attorney.
Who is free to function as a corporate attorney in other cases. So this is somebody who routinely represents corporations in these kinds of cases. And so, you know, today he's representing Monsanto against, you know, the government of Canada. Tomorrow he's a judge in a case. And just to, you know, like show the difference in the labor rights disputes, you can't, labor unions, workers cannot bring cases like you can under the ISDS. What you have to do is get your government or the government of another country to bring the case. Okay, so for instance, say there's slavery in Vietnam. How do you get it adjudicated? Well, a U.S. union has to go to the U.S. government and have the U.S. government file a complaint against Vietnam. Do you see the difference in the, you know, the power to use the dispute resolution system between the labor and environmental stuff and the corporate power?
You've been listening to Judy Ansel and Jim Turner break down the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. And I think this was very worthwhile. Hope we all learned something from this program. This was recorded on Sunday, March 27th of 2016 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church at 4501 Walnut Street in Kansas City, Missouri. This program is produced and edited for broadcast each week by Barry Lee. Thanks to Rita Norton and her staff at All Souls for their help each week in providing us the material for this show. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each program is composed and recorded and performed by Fred Potter. Don't forget that this program and other programs from the All Souls Forum series are available in podcast form on the KKFI website under our podcast button. We also have a variety of other fine public affairs shows available for you to check out, and you can download them or stream them however you prefer to listen to them. We'll see you again next week right here, same time, same place. You've been listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.